You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 28th of May to the 3rd of June 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Ellie Bothwell, Holly Elson, Chris Havergal and books editor Karen Shook. Is the opening of branch campuses or overseas outposts of universities now a bit passé, a bit out of date and no longer a priority? A major study suggests that this is the case, and Chris will bring us up to date on that in just a second. Is there a mismatch between the number of people with PhDs and the number of permanent academic posts available? Something we've covered a few times in Times Higher, and Holly has an update. What's in our books section this week? Karen will reveal all shortly. And finally, how many of the world's top 200 institutions are led by women? Find out from Ellie a little bit later on. But first, Chris, our splash this week is on branch campuses. Now, they used to be the thing to do for universities expecting to grow their overseas student numbers, looking to expand their reach. Not so much the case anymore.
That's right. You're right to say that once there was a time when people thought the internationalisation of higher education basically meant opening branch campuses. Mm. That's why the finding in a major survey by the European Association for International Education is particularly striking. They spoke to more than 1,000 university employees across Europe, and asking them about the trends that they had seen in their institutions' internationalisation activities in the last 3 years, just 1% said that they had seen a substantial increase in branch campus activity in that time, and only 12% said they had seen an increase. Mm-hmm. The UK has led the way, of course, for branch campuses in Europe. UK universities have set up about 1 in 3 branch campuses with European parent institutions. But when you look at the UK results in isolation, branch campuses don't figure highly there either.
Mm, what's the reason? What alternatives are there? What are people focusing on instead?
Well, I mean, you can look at some of the examples of recent closures. We've heard of University College London shutting down its operations in Australia, University of East London closing its Cyprus arm. That was poor recruitment. I mean, in short, I mean, branch campuses are quite expensive. Because of the local financing rules and regulations, it's quite hard to make money out of them or get any of that money back to the UK. And then there's also reputational risks. You only have to look at some of the problems which particularly US universities have had operating in the Middle East around issues of freedom of speech and academic freedom, to see that, you know, a lot of universities will be looking at these and thinking, well, you know, is it worth the trouble? Mm. Especially when, if you set yourself up as a branch campus, you're effectively competing with local universities. Whereas if you look for other options, for example, dual and joint degrees, partnerships, staff and student exchanges, you can work with those local universities without that risk of financial and reputational damage.
Yeah, I remember when UEA announced it was to close, or at least considering closing its London campus, one of the reasons they gave was online courses. They've invested quite heavily in MOOCs. Online courses aren't only MOOCs, but we always find ourselves mentioning them. And that was a way they could reach a lot more people in a lot more countries a lot more cheaply than bricks and mortar. And I guess there's a certain amount of that regarding international campuses
too. Certainly. Speaking to Nigel Healy, he's the Pro Vice Chancellor International at Nottingham Trent University. He raises the interesting suggestion that we may now be at peak branch campuses. We've had peak oil, and now we may be on to peak branch campuses. What will be interesting to
Don't
see...
Don't forget peak beard.
Peak beard as
peak
well.
Peak burger, I believe, was about a year ago.
Okay, well, this is branch campuses. What I think it will be interesting to do is maybe... This is the first time that the EAIE has done this study. It'll be particularly interesting to see if they repeat it. I think they're going to do it in a couple of years' time to see whether, you know, it really is the peak or whether there is you know, a second wind for branch campuses.
Well, page 6 and 7 for that write-up from Chris. Thanks for that. Holly, moving on. Too many PhDs, not enough academic jobs. It's a familiar story, and we revisit it this week because of a report by the European Science Foundation.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, this, carrying on Chris's theme, we could now be at peak PhD. So this report looks at tracked the careers of about 500 PhD students coming out of 500 PhD students coming out of 5 different research organisations, anywhere between a year and 7 years after finishing their PhD, and sort of got them to fill out a questionnaire about their work and their life. And it found that almost all of them were employed, 90% in research, but only about 30% had some kind of stable job, a tenured post, for example. And this is despite all of the people, almost all of the people surveying, wanting a career in academia. Mm. And one of the main conclusions from the report was that this kind of insecure employment, people on short-term contracts back-to-back, which we often hear about in this post-PhD period, is causing them considerable stress and career dissatisfaction.
Mm. I mean, we visited this topic last year in November. A THE investigation revealed that in some Russell Group institutions, as many as 200 applicants were chasing every early career post. And early career researchers are signing up to a nomadic life in many ways, aren't they? They have to go from place to place, contract to contract. Doesn't sound like much fun.
No, exactly. And we often hear of these issues. And what was important, what was interesting in the report is they were talking about how they actually... PhDs are now becoming shorter as funding is sort of squeezed across more people, and universities are really ramping up the production of people with doctorates. So that competition, I guess, in the future is only going to increase further.
Indeed. Well, page 8 for that very interesting write-up this week. It'll also be, of course, on timeshighereducation.co.uk. Moving on, Karen, what's in the books section this week?
Well, seemingly no book section would be complete without either Hitler or Stalin. This week it's Stalin. Robert Galateli, the eminent historian, looks at Oleg Klevniuk's book, Stalin, New Biography of a Dictator, thinking about what made him tick. Also this week, Stuart Lansley reviews Lord Desai's book, Hubris, Why Economists Failed to Predict the Crisis and How to Avoid the Next One, after books on Hitler and Stalin. The most common books of those I receive are ones about the economic crisis, who predicted it, and how to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Vince Cable predicted it, didn't he? He got a lot of traction out of that for years.
Apparently so. I haven't had his book yet, and he's not an academic, although he is does have a PhD. Meghnad Desai, of course, is a very eminent economist at London School of Economics, so if you're going to look for reasons, you might well turn to his. Interestingly, this week, a fantastic book by Aminul Haque, who is a British Bangladeshi academic at Goldsmiths. His book, British Islamic Identity, Third Generation Bangladeshis from East London, focuses on a very small cohort of young people, 6 teenagers from East London, what they think about their dual or, in fact, triple identities. One of the fascinating things he discovered was that... these young people tend to be embarrassed by their own grandparents' Bangladeshi background and identify very closely with their Muslim identities, and specifically with the Arabic language, which they will have learned at the mosque or at school. So while they see it as a little bit embarrassing to think about their grandparents' background, they're quite interested in their Islamic faith, but just more with regard to the Arabic language tradition. Also this week, Ruth Richardson, the scholar who discovered Dickens' Workhouse, reviews Dickens and the Business of Death by Claire Wood, and Emmanuel Haque at Manchester reviews Paying Bribes for Public Services, A Global Guide to Grassroots Corruption. Richard Rose and Karen Pfeiffer found some interesting things which Emmanuel highlights. One, in countries where the press is most free, the likelihood of paying a bribe is reduced by 13 percentage points. And also, the less contact you have with public officials and the greater availability of public service and reduced regulation, those are linked to lower incidences of bribery as well. The more services are done online, the less there's face-to-face contact, I guess, the less likely backhanders can be exchanged. Also this week we look at the Empire Cinema of the Italian fascist era. Before Fellini was dealing with dwarfs, he was cozy with fascists, so we hear. And on the Italian theme continues with our book of the week. The eminent scholar Jane Tylis from New York University's latest book is Siena, City of Secrets, Philip Cook from Strathclyde reviewed this for us. He actually hated Siena when he was there as a student and was a bit iffy on taking it on, but he has been convinced by Tylis, who's very well known for her work on Catherine and Siena. So here she shifted from the saint to the city. And if you want to have a few high culture reference points for your next weekend break, this might be the book for you.
Absolutely do, yes. Thanks for that, Karen. It's well worth a read our books section. If you click the books tab on our website, you will find you'll find all of those reviews. And also, Karen, you're always on the lookout for people to tell you what they're reading.
Yes, I have a weekly column called What Are You Reading? Featuring contributions from academics and former academics and administrators and doctoral candidates. If anyone would like to make a contribution, send me an email at karen.shook@tezglobal.com. I'd love to hear from you and I can tell you what I'm looking for. We know everybody reads books. I'd like to know what you're reading.
Great, thanks, Karen. And finally, I crunched a few numbers a few weeks ago, and in the UK, 21 out of 133 universities are led by women. That's according to the UUK list. Ellie, you've been crunching the numbers at a more global level.
Yes, and the picture is not great there either. Only 28 out of the top 200 universities in the world are led by women. It was using data from our World University Rankings. And that number's soon going to be 26 as well, because two of those universities are going to be led by men by the end of the summer. Most of those female leaders are institutions in the UK and the US, which isn't surprising because those nations dominate the top university list, but they still have very small percentage of their overall leaders are women. And 19 out of the 28 countries in the overall list don't have any female leaders, so it's very disappointing results.
And these are going to be presented at a conference soon, is that right?
Yes, that's right. They're going to be presented at the British Council's Going Global conference, which is 1st and 2nd of June, by Miguel Antonio Lim, who is an EU Marie Curie doctoral fellow at Aarhus University in Copenhagen.
Indeed, that's a conference we'll be following closely. We'll hope to have live sessions streaming on our website from there as well, so keep an eye on the video section at timeshighereducation.co.uk. That's all for this podcast. Just to flag up a couple of other articles this week, in our features section, Laurie Taylor examines the relationship between academics, and administrators in his own inimitable style. And John Marcus writes on US fraternities at Dog Dubai scandal. Is it time they were shut down for good? That's all for this week's podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you can do so on our website. You'll also find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on Google+, so please do get in touch. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.